It is a hobby that you can pursue once you have achieved all the standardized processes which were laid down by the society and you excel at them. You
Yeah,
get
yeah.
good marks in school, you go to good college, secure great placements, do higher studies, and once you've
Yeah.
settled down, once you have that locked in, then you have all the time, to do your hobbies and pursue your hobbies. Unfortunately, by the time you would look up, you're already in your mid-30s and late-40s, and there is no time to pursue any hobby. Your customers really don't care about technology at the back end. They would always go with how you make them feel. Humans till the time, we don't, or AIs don't take over our thinking capacities and capacities. I think we will still be emotional and irrational people. We will still take decisions based on how a certain company or a certain business or a certain person makes us feel.
Swapnil, first of all, I
Awesome.
would say, thank you so much for your time. I have been excited to talk to you. I think the first conversation we had was quite interesting and very deep. And I was not expecting to talk for so long on an intro call, but well, it happened as it happened. And today I have a lot of questions for you. And I'm just very excited to talk to you, man. So welcome to the Research Labs podcast.
Same here. Thanks for having me. Again, referring to our last call, it's been phenomenal. I think it was a pretty, I think it you could probably call it a serendipitous call, because anyways, I think neither of us were expecting that call to extend the way it extended. And thanks for having me here. I think you guys are doing some great job. Yeah.
How about we go back and we go back to the early days when you got started, and maybe not even college, right? Even before that, and just walk us through how that time was like for you, especially.
Wow. Okay. Interesting. I don't think that I've ever started a conversation with that as a premise. But fine. I think I would rather. Right. So I think it all comes with. I'll probably start from the very beginning. Right. I come from a very. I will not say a very humble background, but like a typical middle class Indian family where you are doing enough to eat all the meals, to have a roof over your head, and parents who would like to do whatever they can in their power to keep their child safe, secure, healthy, and happy. Correct? So, coming from that background of love, abundance, I think that from a very young age, and this I'm all talking in hindsight, right? There are certain things that you tend to pick up as a child without knowing that you're picking up things from your surroundings and from your parents and your family members, right? So that's the beginning. Born and brought up in a typical Maharashtrian family in a typical small town. Well, then it was a small town, Nagpur. Now it's a fairly large and fast-growing city. So yeah, I mean that's the very beginning of it. Been, you know, I've always, and I'm the only child, so that also comes with its own sets of advantages and disadvantages. The biggest advantage being you are literally the king of the house. You can demand and you'll get whatever you ask for. So, correct. So, a lot of values and discipline growing up as a child. The schooling and the college has always been in a convent school. But as funny as it may sound, I think I was not a very big fan of my school time though. It took me, when people ask me, how was your school? How was your college? I was like, I spent 8 years to forget my school years. I never really quite enjoyed it. Never really felt that I belonged in a very in a systemic environment where everything is so predefined and so standardized. And whatever other likes and hobbies that you may have, we are so strongly discouraged. And suddenly, when I moved to college, suddenly you realize that the world is such a better and bigger place where you can actually explore things. You can go to different places. You can talk to so many people. You are allowed to do so many different things. And I think, college is where I really kind of discovered myself. Yeah, I think so. That's where I think that's what, and it's where I I think I made friends for life in college. I discovered my accidental discovery of my profession in college and so on and so forth. So that was really the starting point, I'd like to say, from the college standpoint.
And how was school like? Was it very interesting? Was it disturbing? Was it?
But not really. It was a, I think, nothing against the schools, I think the schools are great places for you to actually learn and pick up things. But for me personally, I think I was confused at the time. Now with whatever wisdom and with
I
whatever
see.
life experience and life lessons that you have, in hindsight, you realize that I never felt belonged in that ecosystem. I always thought that there is so much better that I could do with better people around me, better,
Yeah.
better teachers and better guides to figure out or to pinpoint like what are the strengths and what are the weaknesses of each student, not just me, but for everyone else. And to my surprise, everybody just kind of accepted the way the things were. And I, for the life of me, I couldn't understand then. And that obviously would result in average marks and average, almost every day there would be a remark in my diary and, so on and so forth, right? And
It's
I
a
was always a
very
backbencher.
convent school thing.
Very convent school, and always been a backbencher, not because I was a bad student or I was a naughty kid, but because my height was, I was probably the tallest in the class. So I think, despite being a very good trait for you as a person, suddenly you are punished for it, and
Yeah.
suddenly somebody else decided that you will not sit with the in the front bench where the top performers would sit because you are tall, and hence will sit at the back bench where people, we all know that back benches are people who are teachers would like to keep them at the back because they are either notorious students or they're not that great at studies and so on and so forth. So it I all these principles, this just didn't relate with me, and I was like kind of feeling lost. But though the best part for me in school was all the extracurricular activities, like I used to take part in my debate competitions, I used to write plays, I used to act in plays, and so that's where I think, again, in hindsight, vision is 2020, right? Now I know that I've always been, I have had a slightly more creative bent of mind early on, but because at the time, and I'm talking about late 80s, early 90s, creativity is not was not as celebrated as what we do now, correct? So then it was always just to be good marks, study hard, get good marks, get into good college, and then get good job. A pretty linear, standardized path of progression in life.
Yeah,
So I think,
creativity was all supposed to be like a side thing always. Like it's a hobby. That's all it
yeah,
is.
it is a hobby that you can pursue once you have achieved all the standardized processes which were laid down by the society and you excel at them. You get good marks in school, you go to good college, secure great placements, do higher studies, and once you settle down, once you have that locked in, then you have all the time, to do your hobbies and pursue your hobbies. Unfortunately, by the time you would look up, you're already in your mid-30s and late-40s, and there is no time to pursue any hobby. So
So I would like to add to this, right? Even I'm the only child, went to convent, had a very strict school system. If you are 10 minutes late, you went back home that day, right? If your hair did not have oil, you went back home, you added oil, and then you came back to the school for the next period. So
correct.
pretty, I can completely relate to the strictness of it.
Yes.
And I would say in college, right, I went the opposite route because of that. I'm like, I don't like structure. Like I hated structure after that, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing, right? If you push people against their will to do a certain thing, the only thing you're doing is you're creating rebels for the future, right? I remember when I went to college, it was just so liberating to wear, different colored clothes every day. And that I'm not saying that, it's like all schools have uniform, which is not bad, but it's just, I think every person, every student, kind of feels that, and I think that is probably the first time that you actually sense this, the world is a much bigger place and an open place for you, that you can actually do lit you can literally do anything. And there are these simple acts of daily acts that you keep doing. So I think it was pretty fascinating at the time.
But you know, on the contrary, I also feel like the structure, right? I cannot really say for sure if it's unnecessary. Do you know what I mean? Like, because I was in school like that, just the way you were, right? I'm not really sure what the opposite will do. Like, what if the college liberation happened earlier? Would it be good for us, bad for us? I don't know, you know?
Yes. And I think that's a very fair point. And I'm not going to counter that. But what happens now is, even in the convents, right? And I think it's just how the society also evolves, right? I mean, there are some macro trends, you know, which would percolate down through all the ecosystems of the society, right? I mean, if the macro trend today is where you celebrate creativity, you celebrate independence, you celebrate individuality of people, correct? That was not the case, you know, right in the peak of, say, 60s, 70s or 80s even, correct? It's only in the late 90s, early 2000s, with the advent of internet or globalization, people getting more exposure to other forms of or other varieties of the same things that, you know, you can do. That's where people's thinking kind of opened up and things started to change little by little. So yeah, I think schools of today, they look very, very different than schools of 80s and 90s. I can assure you that. You talk to any, you talk to any person who's been into Indian schools in late 80s and early 90s, I think they can vouch for that. Like, I have my friends who go and drop their children to school, and it's like, bro, I think why the hell we did not have schools like this back then? Yeah, you can actually see regret in their face. You know, like, can we go and spend? People today, they love to go to parent teachers meet because the schools is just, it's the entire atmosphere, the entire environment is so inviting.
Earlier,
it used to be like, you know, I don't
you
see
feel
kids crying anymore. I don't see kids crying anymore before going to school. And I could not find a single child who would go happily to school in our times. You know, I think there is a difference, and I think there is a good reason for that.
So you go to college, you find liberation, and how was that process like? Were you interested in too many things, and it was difficult to like kind of decide what's next for you, or you just kind of fell into place to do what you did?
Well, okay, so I think there are a bunch of things that happened between school and college. Throughout the school, you know, at least towards my final years of school and my junior college, I was pretty sure that I want to get into medical. So I was preparing, you know, I spent about 2 or 2.5 years getting into medical, because that's something that I genuinely wanted to do. It's not because, you know, like a typical career path, either be an engineer or be a doctor. And I got a good percentile from the entrance test, but somehow I managed to drop down my grades for my 12th, and hence I could not get to the medical college I wanted to get in. And that kind of, you know, really put me back mentally, you know, and emotionally quite a bit. And that resulted me in dropping out for about 6 months into the academic year. And that's how I just ended up doing, you know, getting into the college. You know, we just had that one course and that one seat available. So I ended up, you know, getting admitted to the Bachelor's of Science, and I did my majors in botany, which has absolutely nothing to do with whatever I've, you know, ended doing up in the rest of my life. You know, but again, you know, you needed a degree, you needed to have something. So I always call my graduation as, it's a hangover degree, or it's a hangover decision that I had. You know, it was not what was meant to be, but I think that's what was, I think, it's not what I wanted, but I think it was what it was meant to be. So I think I'm good with that. So once I got there, you know, obviously, then suddenly, even if I didn't want, I was the guy who joined college 6 months late. So everybody kind of knew me, even if I didn't want them to know me. Correct. So I had this advantage to me where, you know, I suddenly become a celebrity. And like, the one person who never showed up in the college, and suddenly he did. And they're like, this is how that guy looks. And from day one, I think I had a very bunch of good friends. You know, I met pretty good friends. I'm still friends with most of them. And as I, started to go through it, I realized that there is a lot that can be done. With the way the college communicates with its students and their parents and with their faculties. So the first thing that I did was, I went to the HOD of my college for, I think it was biology HOD, and I went and told them that, why don't we have thematic posters, for the next season, the new batch which is coming in. I think we should have these 20 or 25 thematic posters all across the hallway so that they get inducted, pretty well. And the concepts that you are teaching us, I think it'll just be a good for us to for them to keep having look at them, in the biology in the labs or in the hallways in the classrooms and so on and so forth. And why don't we create, individual brochures for our course and so on and so forth. Why don't we get, now they are called testimonials, but then I was thinking, why don't we get our old students, who have done their PhDs and who've been and working somewhere, why don't we get them to write something, like a message for the incoming batch? And I started doing these little stupid things, and slowly and steadily, I think by the end of my second year and early final year, I must have written about 14 odd brochures for different departments across the college. I was the go-to guy to get any creative work done for the college. And that's when I realized, okay, I think this is a good place to be. I was just, it just felt very good to contribute something, which is just going to stay behind, even after I would have left the college. And that's when I got my first advertising freelance gig, where I started writing ads for local businesses and, other businesses and so on and so forth. And once I realized what advertising is and what it does, and mind you, till then I had no idea what how advertising works or what advertising is. You would just see these blocks of creative, communication in the newspaper, and you would see this, a fairly long commercial on the TV in between, serials and in between matches. But that's what it was. But then, as I started doing it, as I started writing it, is when I realized, advertising is where I felt most alive, and then when I just kind of embarked on that journey. So that's how it's been. It's been about almost 20 years now.
And so you start freelancing, right? What happens then? Do you kind of go, maybe I should start a company of my own, or I should get a job, or I should do an MBA?
None of that, actually. I was just so happy that, as a 18-year-old, I was making some amount of money, and I didn't have to go back to my parents, to ask them for money to get, put fuel in my bike, or, just to go out and party with children, with my friends. I think I was just way too, happy doing it. Studying, I used to play university level basketball at the time, so I was just, probably I had the best 3, 3.5 years of my life, doing that. Only once the college got over is when there was this one, pretty well-known local advertising agency in Nagpur. So they reached out to me saying that, why don't you come and join us, and we will also give you a formal education in advertising and so on and so forth. And I had nothing to lose. I was like, if you're paying me and I'm going to get learning from it, like, why not? I think it just sounded a very good deal at the time, that you would pay me stipend and then you will teach me also. So fine, why not? I for a while I thought about doing an MBA, and while I was working, I also prepared for my CAT. But by the time, a year went by, and and in the meantime, most of my friends, they got into some or the other MBA colleges, and they would come back in their holidays. They would come back to their hometown, and we would meet up. In all the conversations that I've had with them while they were in their second or third semester, and the value that I would add to those conversations, I genuinely thought that there is a huge gap. And if these guys, they are getting, if they're studying in the top 25, 30 colleges in the country, and here I am working in a very small agency in a very small city. But at the same time, if there is nothing new that these guys can tell me, Well, that tells a lot about the education that these guys are getting, and you know that was a big bummer for me. And I think that's when I kind of decided I would rather work for the next 3-4 years and you know get on the job training than wasting 2 years doing MBA.
Yeah.
And as I talk to my friends even now, I always tell them that you know I have had a very healthy disrespect for MBAs at the time. I still continue to do so without judging them. I have nothing against people who do MBAs. I think there are millions of people who do it across the world. But
yeah,
given a choice, I would not do it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think so that was how I got inducted. And after that freelance gig, so obviously this agency, they offered me a full-time job and I continued with them for the next good amount, I think about almost about 3 years I worked with them.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I also kind of realized that, you know, being creative is good. Being able to write is great. But what's even greater is when you know how the customers are thinking and how customers perceive your brand and how do you help brands communicate better, you know, in the more strategic way, and not just because it sounds good and just because it feels good or because it looks good. That's when I realized, you know, there is a lot behind, you know, and even if you're a writer, right, like now it's become much more obvious that copywriting is the new skill, right? If you are copywriting is the skill today, you know, which will get you, you know, you can make your first internet dollars only through copywriting, right? I mean, all those things are well established now, but back then, you know, copywriting was looked upon as a standalone feature, you know, and not as a piece of a big strategic puzzle that you're trying to solve for any brand or for any company. And that's, you know, that kind of took me some time to understand. And that's where the shift happened. So from being a creative person, I gradually moved to more strategic roles where I, you know, get into brand strategy, launches, go-to-market strategies, and so on and so forth.
And so, you know, technology is evolving really fast now. How do you see, you know, branding and marketing is also evolving with it? And well, how did you discover that, you know, okay, like every 2-3 years, right, there is a new tech, there is a new way of doing things, and the whole, I won't say industry because it's a very loose term to talk about it, but more like the landscape completely changes, right? So how have you made sure that, you know, you are kind of aware about what's coming next?
Wow. Okay. So I think there would be a fairly long and smart sounding answer, but I think I'll go with, so you know what it, you know what it truly felt like at the time. Very earlier in my career, right? I mean, you do realize that there is something more, you know, once you've worked in a field like advertising, you know, where you're exposed to multiple categories and multiple industries, you know, and mind you, each of these industries would have their own inflection points, their, you know, their peaks and their troughs, correct? If you have a client who at the time, you know, would be a manufacturer versus if your client who was a tech client, you know, both would have a very different, the same year would look very different for both of them.
Correct? Yeah.
And the best thing that advertising did to me was allow me to have, you know, like almost like a bird's eye view of different things happening in different industries, you know, and
yeah.
Without me being any of those, you know, I realized that every business has a cycle, every technology has a cycle, correct? If, you know, one of my clients at the time, you know, he was the largest kids manufacturer brand in the country.
Yeah.
You know, and I could see the shift in the way they would design clothes or they would cut their clothes or how, you know, they would present their clothes in the retail, you know, in their retail outlets. So,
yeah.
And for me as an outsider, that gave me a very good view of how the things are changing in different industries. And instantly, you know, you realize that you're at the end of it, right? For an outsider, advertising also is going to change and has changed quite a lot over the last years, so many years.
Yeah.
And then once you have that realization that, every business or every industry or every technology is going to evolve over a period of time, and almost every business will have cycles, without having experienced it by yourself, and being able to discuss that with the seniors or with your mentors kind of gave me a very, good idea as to, how would my or how could my career look like. Obviously, I did not have a very clear understanding as to, like by this year I want to do this. I did not have clear timelines, but like by 2006, 2007, it was fairly evident that, back in the day we used to have Yahoo chats and Orkuts. It was fairly evident at the time that, there will be a time when suddenly internet is going to be a fairly important part of communication and advertising, and not just TV commercials or outdoor hoardings or, paper ads or whatever. The traditional medium of advertising will not be enough. Towards the end of the decade, 2009, 2010, I think it became almost clear that, digital marketing or internet marketing is going to be the way forward. I think that was also the time when most legacy businesses started to get their own websites. It's very funny to even look at 10 years back, and thinking that we did not have, social media, or we did not have digital marketing as a function, even like as recent as like 10 to 12 years. It just feels like, the pace with which things are moving, it's almost impossible to imagine that there was a time when none of this existed. But it did not, right? I mean, 2009, 2010, I can tell from my personal experience, it would be such a difficult thing to get hold of development agencies, who would create websites for you, and it would take months, if not years, to get one website done. Correct? And the amount of content that you had to write and all the cycles, it was almost as if, you have the principles of the old world and you are trying to implement, or you are going to the next revolution or the next transformation with the same old principles. Correct? And that's what it took for the first 3, 4 years for businesses and for the industry at large, marketing industry at large, to realize that there is a, like, we will have to start afresh. We cannot go to the new world with the same rules that applied in the old world. And with that, so till 2000, I think that's even when I made that transition, personally, in my career, where, I think 2011 is the time when I kind of moved away from traditional advertising and marketing, and started completely focusing on digital marketing, as a focus, because that's where most businesses were willing to experiment and willing to pay. As an agency, one thing you have to realize if you're working in any agency is it's, or for that matter, any service business, you're always working on thin margins. So from the business standpoint as well, if you have the service that customers are willing to pay premium for, that's where, you want to put your focus on. And unfortunately, I think what has also happened is, though, and this we can probably, talk in the later part of the conversation as well if it goes to that, but, just to briefly touch upon it, is agencies, till about 70s or 80s were seen to be the people who would drive the action, on the brands, on the brands end as well, where the agencies would decide and would at least be at the same talking field or, playing field with the brand heads or the brand owners or the brand managers, right? And I think that's where the mistake was. Even we did not even have brand heads and brand managers then. You would directly talk to the person who's created the brand, right? So you would talk to the owners, and you would talk to people who had their skin in the game, and things would move fast. Correct. What changed since then is, A, clients started to become more hierarchical. Agencies have started to become more hierarchical. And somewhere, in the last 15 years or so, I think agencies have just kind of played a catch-up game. We've not been the proactive selves that we were. I don't remember a single time since 20, like in the last 7, 8 years, like I will not go further than that, that an agency has come to a client and, decided the way forward. At least not in my peer group or network. Somewhere some agency would have done that and they would have gotten cans for it. But most of the agencies, they have just become great executioners and not the thinkers or not the torchbearers that we were used to be. And I think that's when, you know, you realize that if clients are the ones who are going to define the relationship going forward, then what is the future of the agencies? You know, I think, and that is when I, you know, after multiple, you know, conflicting chats with myself and with my people around me is when I, you know, decided, like, you know, I'll quit the agency full time and I'll probably just do something on my own. So
how was that like, you know, starting out in, not in an, again, not the word industry, but like starting out in a field and then, you know, witness the whole thing go upside down or sideways, I don't know. And then kind of understanding that, okay, when I started, this was like a mall. Now it's like a small store. And if I don't, like, do you feel like, you know, you were kind of forced to evolve?
I think we all are. You know, if given a choice, none of us would want to, you know, none of us would want to change the way things are, right? But that's not how the nature works, or anything works for that matter, correct? The fact that today we are here having this call is because of, you know, certain thousands and millions of changes that has happened, that have happened in the last so many days, months and years, right? So you are always forced to evolve. Nobody, at least in my experience and in my view, I think nobody evolves voluntarily, correct? There is always something or the other which would push you to evolve. Now, what are those triggers and what are those motivations? And, you know, what is the reason behind your evolution? I mean, that is the nuance, and that is where, you know, your growth kind of, you know, your growth path is kind of well defined. But everyone would have some motivation or some trigger. And so is the case with me, right? For me, it was, I just could not relate to the work that I was doing. I could not relate to the fact that how an agency, or how anyone for that matter, could do business with someone when they are not held accountable for what they are doing, correct? How can there be a relationship or an association where both do not have equal say? I understand the stakes are different, but if you do not have an equal say as the other stakeholders, then what is the point in being in that association or that relationship? So a lot of these things kind of, you know, started conflicting with my, you know, with my view of world, which was also evolving, correct? So, I mean, today, Prathamesh, who is running the Research Labs podcast, versus Prathamesh, who is viewing the world as a citizen of the world, I mean, both would have a very different point of views, right? I mean, and both of them may not necessarily evolve or change at the same time, or both of them may not necessarily also have the same viewpoint at times, correct? Yeah. Like, as a citizen of the world, you know, there are certain beliefs that you develop, you know, by seeing things around you, by things happening to you, you know, by your own life lessons. And then there is the work thing, right? Where you know exactly how, you know, how to record a podcast, you know, how to get the guests in and so on and so forth, correct? The moment that technology changes, the working you is going to adapt to that technology, correct? But as a citizen, if, you know, there are certain changes happening in the geopolitical sense, so that is also going to align your views to a certain way and change them in a certain way. So
yeah.
I think there's always that, you know, duality in all of us, I believe.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I think so. That's how even, you know, I decided that, you know, maybe this is not for me anymore. And I just wanted to take a break. And then I decided, you know, even if, so at the time I was in Bombay, you know, and in between all these years, you know, I think I just kept on moving cities, you know, across the country and stayed in multiple places and so on and so forth. But then I decided if I want to quit advertising, or if I want to take a break, then Bombay is not a very convenient place for me to do that, right? For me as a person and for me as a professional. So I decided, you know, if I want to change, I want to change everything. So I decided, fine, I'll quit my full-time job. I will change the city, and I will also change my surroundings and the kind of people that I'm going to surround myself with.
Yeah.
So I moved to Goa, after I quit my full time. And so the chances of failure or the cost of failure was much lesser for me in Goa. If things didn't work out, I'm not paying as much rent as I'm paying in Bombay. So I think that was the whole intention. Like, if things don't work out in the next 6 months, at least I'm not paying, or my cost of living is not as high as in Bombay. And obviously that would give me a fairly long runway to sustain as well. So that was like the basic thinking at the time.
Do you kind of, I don't know, I have this understanding that whatever you just said to me, right, it is so new. Like if you talk like this to our parents, they will be like, break from a career? What are you saying?
Tell that to my mom. The amount of time she must have, I think, at the time, and it just sounds very easy now when I speak about it, right? I mean, obviously, it was not a very easy thing to do at the time. So, yeah. Any Asian parent, for that matter, I think you tell them that you want to take a career break, is like, are you okay?
Are you, but you did this for all your life. What is wrong?
That exactly is what is wrong,
I want to focus a little bit more on technology, right? That, and I also have my reasons for it. In 2019, I got the opportunity to be in New York for a while, and I was talking to people who do business there, all right. And I also introduced myself as, someone who started a company in India, and I'm just here for like a visit. And there were a few people who were, I would say, very cool in my personal opinion assessment, and they straight up told me that, you guys don't know how to use the internet, right? And I've been using the internet since almost forever. So I asked them, like, what do you mean by that? And he's like, no, you guys don't know how to use the internet. By you guys, he mean businessmen in India. That's what he meant, right? So I asked him, like, what do you mean by that? And so that gentleman, right, he runs a travel agency. He has, I think, I don't know, 30 odd employees who he has never met. And they run like a membership club where if you join the membership, they will design travel plans for you. Very basic business, right? I mean, we see it all around. But he has customers in like 50 countries. And he has never met any of the employees or the customers. But, he's big, right? And he shared like few things about, how he pulled the whole thing off. And it just opened my mind up. I was like, wait a minute. The technology is there. The technology is at a place where what he is doing is possible for anyone who, sets like understands it in a different way, maybe, right? So my takeaway from that, I would say, story, right, is that, oh, wait a minute. Why am I even pitching myself as a Indian brand? Like, how does it matter? I am a brand. I am on the internet. So why add American, Indian, anything to it? Like, who cares, right? And so you mentioned copywriting, right? I think that was a shift when I understood that, wait a minute, the copy I am writing or the way I am presenting, I don't need to talk to a guy in Delhi anymore. I don't need to talk to a guy in New York anymore. Like, I don't have to be that specific. If I can somehow figure out a way to communicate with anyone on the planet who understands English, well, that's what I want to go for now. Right. And on Netflix, right, there is a show called Patriot Act by Hasan Minhaj. And I became a fan of the show briefly, and then it was slightly boring towards the end. But in an interview, I think the New York Times was interviewing Hasan Minhaj, and they were asking him, like, what is the principle that you follow when thinking of an episode. And what he said just resonated with me. He's like, see, I am talking about, he's like, out of the 20 episodes we do, only six of them are on America, about America. 14 of them are about other countries on the planet. And he's like, That's because my show goes on Netflix and on YouTube. And Netflix and YouTube is available in all those countries. So when I talk about, let's say, a problem in Saudi Arabia, or when I talk about a problem in Australia, or when I talk about a problem in India, because he did, right? He did cricket and Indian politics. He's like, people from there like it because I'm telling their story on this platform. And he's like, gone are the days when you have to think about geography when talking about, when telling a story. And like, you know, when I'm listening to what he's saying, right, I understand what he's saying, okay? But I would say it took me, I would say, like 2 to 3 months to take into consideration the technology that I know how to use, that is in front of me, and what he is saying, okay? And that's when we thought, oh, wait a minute, let's build research labs independent of the geographical location. Like, who cares? As far as I am talking about humanity, and I'm talking about human ability, and I'm talking about failure and success, everyone will understand it, no matter who you are or what culture you come from. And that's how we are trying to build Sunday Pajamas now. Does it make sense?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. I think if you would see me, you know, like, I'm just nodding pretty vigorously to everything that you're saying, is because I think it makes perfect sense, right? As I was saying earlier, right? I mean, there are these macro trends and there are these micro trends, right? I mean, the macro trend today is that technology is kind of bringing all of us together, correct?
Yeah.
The entry barrier and the frictions, I think they are getting reduced every minute, you know, I think. And, you know, today, we do not even know how things will be, you know, 6 months or a year down the line. We did not know that we would have a generative AI, you know.
We did not know
that GPT-3 would exist a year back. Now we have GPT-3, now we have Dolly, we have Midjourney, we have Stable Diffusion, and so on and so forth, right? We have Steve Jobs getting interviewed by Joe Rogan, you know, after his death. So things are happening, you know, we are getting into that.
That's a bit crazy.
So we are stepping into, you know, we are getting into the phase where I think technology is just going to bring people closer, right? So, and it makes perfect sense. So that is the micro trend. The micro trend then is, how do you connect those dots and, you know, make use of it today in your business, you know, which will impact you this week and today, you know, not keep, you know, like, what will happen next year? No, you can use that today. You know, and you were mentioning that. I mean, you, the way you and the team kind of experimented with multiple platforms, so where you signed up people from multiple countries and so on and so forth. So I think that is what's happening. I think the Pareto principle, I think it has been, it has never been so relevant to all of us than what it is right now. It's only the 20% of the effort that you're going to take is going to drive the 80% of the outcome. So I'm, I think you are absolutely right. There is something to be said about technology and its role in the way all of us are going to evolve as people, as businesses, whatever.
It does not make sense. For example, I'll tell you a small story from school. Okay, I had a physics teacher, professor. And in my opinion, he was one of the coolest teachers in school. His name is Anil Pillai. And he was a physicist, like a... Like a proper scientist, right? But he loved teaching, so he taught to make, to support his family also. And every 3-4 months, he would tell us that, students, next week there will be no classes because I just wrote a paper on solid state physics and I'm going to Switzerland to present it. And so we heard the story. And I was a fanboy of scientists at the time. Like, I just loved reading about scientists. And so I was like, this is so cool, man. Like, you wrote a paper, now you get to go to Switzerland. And I don't know, talk to fellow physicists. That is just like a dream come true, right? So like, he would come back and share some stories about how the people are and, you know, what they're doing. And I was like, cool, makes sense. Last week, I interviewed a Polish entrepreneur who is working in AI right now. He developed an AI to help patients with diabetes. So what the AI does, it understands your body. I would say it collects data on what is happening to your body and your blood and your sugar levels, and it predicts what steps you should take to be better. Does it make sense? Yeah. Right. So that was the introduction he gave me before coming on the podcast, and we start talking, and then he tells me that he was actually a scientist in CERN, 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 and he is aware about, you know, nuclear fusion experiment that is happening at CERN, which is also something what my sir was working on. And it's the same scientist that my sir was telling me about when he used to go to Switzerland. Not the same scientist, but the same kind of people my sir was talking about. Right? Yeah, yeah. And that story is like only 9 years old, like 9-10 years before my sir was telling me that. And in 10 years, right, I'm literally interviewing all, like he was a physicist or a scientist at the time. And I'm talking to him and I'm like, okay, if that was cool, then this is way cooler, man. Like what is Absolutely. Happening? Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And his name is Shamak. And we had like a fun discussion about how to pronounce his name. And yeah, it was nice. Like he was telling me about Polish culture and it does not make sense to me. It's just crazy what is happening. Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, like how they used to say earlier, right, then there would be 6 degrees of separation. I think it's probably kind of reduced down to about like 2 or 3 right now, you know, and with metaverse coming in, you know, and whenever that happens, I don't know exactly, but I think things are just going to get much more crazier than this.
Yeah. I don't know. I love technology.
Yeah. Is there any particular technology that you are most excited now, or you are following it closely besides crypto and besides, you know, whatever you're doing?
Yeah. So I would say in 2020, right, we built a product of our own for the first time. We applied to this accelerator called Y Combinator. And we got rejected, but in those 4 months, right, we got introduced to so many new people, a lot of YC alumni. And at that time, right, even when I was in college, I was slightly interested in cloud computing, AWS and GCP and the scale of the cloud right now. But because I was running Sunday Pajamas, I kind of never got the time to actually go deeper into it. And I would say last year, I started learning AWS, and just this Friday, I'm going to talk to an engineer from this company called HashiCorp. Again, in my opinion, it's the smartest company on the planet. And what they do is they make tools to deploy resources on multiple clouds at once. So, for example, if you are building an application for a bank or healthcare, right, then in the old days, you had physical servers to host the app, to store the data. In the early 2006 and 7, AWS was launched, and like moving to the cloud became a thing. And a lot of companies, even today, are trying to migrate their applications on the cloud, including Reliance. Even Reliance is going on AWS, right? And I would say since 2014-15, multi-cloud is becoming more prominent. What multi-cloud means is instead of trusting just AWS, now you can deploy resources on Google Cloud, AWS Cloud, and Azure Cloud at once. And why you do it is because, for example, Google, right, does certain things really well, whereas Amazon does other things really well, and Microsoft does the four or five other things really well, and there are a lot of other, like Oracle is like one of the best databases on the planet. So if you want to build a multi-cloud application to take best of all the worlds, then you can do it now, right? And the one company that makes this whole process 10 times easier is HashiCorp.
Okay.
Yes, and I'm finally going to talk to an engineer from HashiCorp.
Wow,
So
that sounds pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and I don't know. I mean, I'm also trying to talk to a lot of cloud engineers on the podcast,
mm-hmm.
and you know, these are people who have spent, I don't know, 5-6 years on the cloud. Also, if anyone tells you they have been working on the cloud for 20 years, start laughing, because 20 years ago there was no cloud, right?
Yeah.
Like the whole thing started in 2005, 8, 9. Yeah.
Right. So cloud is where you are most interested. Like, you're following that space and you are kind of dipping your feet in that as well.
Yeah. So that is the space we are, I won't say we are heavily working with clients as of right now.
Got it.
But yes, me and my team, along with a few of my friends, they are deep into cloud. So we are collaborating with them to understand, okay, how do you actually build something from scratch?
Got it.
Yeah. But most of the things, right, how we actually keep the whole thing going is we help startups build or design their products.
Mm.
Yeah.
So it's mostly like you're vertically integrating your own services and your expertise, right? From front end to where you host and how they perform and how they scale in the future as well.
So yeah. So it's very nuanced, you know. Like, I would consider myself as someone who is not even a newbie right now. Like, I would say we started Sunday Pajamas more like a let's build brand for the internet kind of a company in the beginning.
Mm.
We did that. And then technology, right, was just too good to ignore.
Correct.
Right. So we were like, okay, let's just start putting ourselves out there in the tech space and just go as deep as you possibly can. Because I don't know, I'm just very interested in technology. Like, everything we were able to do, we don't have a lot of people in the team, but I would say we are able to do so many different things in a very short amount of time because we are very good at technology, you know?
Correct.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think there is something to be said about, you know, like how it allows you to automate mundane and everyday tasks as well.
Like, even Zencastr, right? I think it's so cool. Like, when we started using Zencastr, it was just for recording. And in a year, right, now they allow you to record, to host for free forever, unlimited podcast. They have an advertising network, which will let you earn money from your podcast. They have a editing suite, which will let you edit your podcast. And, and they build the whole thing up in like 1.5 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly, I think, what most product companies are doing. I think, you know, they're just getting started in one of the domains and they just build all the, you know, the horizontal services around it.
Yep.
I think, except for example, if you're somebody like an Anchor FM, you know, where they are just happy hosting and distributing, I don't think that Anchor would ever get into the production, transcribing, editing. I don't know that they've already gotten into it, but I think there are certain tools who would just want to stick.
Oh, there is a reason for it.
Hmm.
Because in 2019-20, Spotify bought Anchor. And at the same time, Spotify bought this other company called Soundtrap. And Soundtrap, think of Soundtrap as a music editing software in the browser. So it lets you basically produce music in the browser if you want to. So you don't need to download like an expensive software and you don't need a very expensive hardware on your PC to produce music anymore. So it has all the instruments. Wow. You can design beats on that. You can make an entire song in the browser now. Just so cool again.
Sick. That's sick.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So the reason to even start the newsletter, right, is because more than what, let's say, we do on the internet, like, you know, we work with clients, we work with startups, and we do a podcast. Dude, I have been obsessed with technology companies since I was in 10th standard. So it's like more than 10 to 12 years now. All right. And I'm looking at so many things. And even when I was in college, right, I would like kind of share with my friends, you know, this is going to happen. This is what Amazon is going to do in the next 2 years. And they'll be like, no, they cannot do that. And then that's what Amazon does in 2-3 years, right? And that's because if you are on the investor pages of Amazon, if you read the boring stuff of all the companies on their website,
absolutely, man.
That's where you understand what the company is really up to. So I have my eyes on all these companies, right? And nobody is talking about it because I don't know why. Because media is only interested in like, okay, Elon Musk. But dude, Elon Musk is just a CEO, okay? He does, I don't know, like 0.001% of the work in Tesla. There are 10,000 people who are doing the actual work, right? But the media never talks about them, right? And so I was like, okay, I need to talk about this because I see so many things happening. And these are the actual things we should care about. Does it make sense?
Yeah, so it does. It does. So
if you read the Tesla article I sent you, right? I did not write the word Elon or Musk at all.
Correct.
Like, that's the point I want to make. Like, we are completely missing what these companies are doing. Right.
Yeah. I think that's where the power of narrative comes in, right? And if over a period of time, you know, people equate the individual with the company, and then, you know, rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
And then
personality,
you know, like, Steve Jobs became much more or much bigger than Apple, correct? So is the case with Elon Musk. So is the case with Jeff Bezos and Amazon. You don't realize that, you know, Jeff Bezos is just, or Elon Musk, they are just the face of the organization that they have built, which over a period of time, those organizations have become, you know, almost animate by themselves, correct?
Yeah.
If you remove people, those companies are not going to get stalled, or they're not, these companies will not burn to the ground. And there are obviously, you know, as you rightly said, that there are about thousands and millions of people who are working on those products and companies and engineering teams and so on and so forth to actually make that happen.
Yeah.
You'd always want to focus on the, you know, like the easy way of the story, the easy way to get the click.
Yeah. Like, for example, last year, Amazon invested in this electric car company called Rivian. And Rivian was trying to compete with Tesla. And I think they will still compete with the electric car business. But the way Amazon did it, right, is that they invested a lot of money into Rivian. That makes sense. And then they placed an order for 100,000 vehicles.
Correct.
To help them with their last mile delivery in America and very soon across the globe. And I don't know. I find strategic partnerships like that very interesting. They don't, I mean, they definitely get some fanfare in the media. But things like this, right, are not being, I would say, taught to students who are growing up right now. In a sense, how do you exactly do something like that? Right?
Yeah.
Like, like we are taught very primitive things. Does it make sense?
Yeah.
And if a student is just getting started, right, it's like they will never be able to get to a level where they will understand things like that. Because the industry is changing way too fast and the education is way too slow. Like, way too slow.
Correct.
Yeah.
But then, you know, also the way I think about this is, you know, someone who is really interested, you know, in knowing these things, they would not rely on their academia to grow in lives, you know, honestly. Right? If I'm a 15-year-old, you know, who is fascinated with the business stories like these, I genuinely will not depend on my professors and teachers to tell me more about it, because the fact is, even they don't know what's happening. They don't even know, you know, they are, I don't know, I think it is a fairly deep rabbit hole, you know, where I think the relevance of education system is fast losing. And, you know, anybody who wants to pursue their passion or their interest, I think they can now, with the tools available to them, you know, they can just pursue that, you know, that their interest, you know, be it professional, vocational, whatever it is, you know, and for free. I mean, YouTube is the biggest university that there is, you know, and they don't charge fees for you.
You know, I have a thought on what you said about this being a business case study, because I don't see it as a business case study actually.
No, what I mean by not as a
In the
case study,
sense,
but you know,
it's
if
more
somebody
like
is
a,
interested in,
yeah, go
sorry,
on.
I think there is a lag. Go on.
Yeah, so I don't know. I really think like you cannot understand this from a business perspective. Like to
Correct.
understand what these companies are really up to, right? You really have to dig deeper and go in the technology side of things, which is like an entire field of study called deep tech. And I want to cover deep tech on this podcast as well. But like I'm not able to find people who talk about those things on the internet. Like they are somewhere hidden and they don't want to talk about it, you know?
I think by definition, right? I mean, if people who are doing deep tech, they will not swim in the shallow waters like social media. So,
Yeah, that I know, right? And that is one more reason to start the newsletter, you know? Because if I really want to talk to someone like that, then I better be off social media and doing something which is not like an Instagram post or something.
correct, correct. No, but I think you are onto something with this thought, you know, where there is always more to everything than meets the eye, right? I mean, there are people who would present and tell story, and there would be people who would actually make things happen. And then there are those, you know, who are driving that vision to, you know, driving that entire thought from vision to execution. And I think there are these multiple, you know, layers to that. So I think if you can get to these people, I think that would be a good niche to look at.
So I was talking to, so we are doing something called the startup program, and that basically means I want to work with founders and CEOs, but not as a consultant. Like
Got it.
I don't want to work as a consultant. I just want to work. Okay. So we have, I think, four or five startups who we are working with. We don't charge anything. We are just working, right? And I would say hope is that it will maybe someday, I don't know when exactly, lead me to a place where, in a room where all these things are done. Does it make sense? And I don't know anyone who can get me there really. So this is more like the most long-term idea I had in my brain. In the sense, okay, I'm too small, and too small in the sense nobody knows me in the industry. I don't know enough. So I'm small in every regard, from a skill perspective, from a brand perspective, from a capital perspective, nothing. None of those three things, right? So, okay, then how do you start something today that will get you in that room in 10 years? Like that was my thought process. And I'm telling you 10 years now because I see some results already. If you met me last year, I would say 25 years, right? Because I could not even see it in front of me, right? But I would say since the day I started Sunday Pajamas, right? The reason I wanted to name the company Sunday Pajamas, it's because it will make everyone tick globally. Like everyone will relate to it. Like the name, okay, everyone knows the word Sunday and pajamas. Everyone knows it. Right. So that was 2016, right? And since then, right, I'm trying to figure out a way to, yes, you can work in a startup and yes, you can work in a company, but that's not what I want to do. Okay. And we somehow along the way kind of figure out a way to, okay, make the money to keep the whole thing going and do the podcast to bring all the people in and learn about how the world is working. But what I really want to do is to somehow get in that room and just see, you know, I don't know, how do you start something like Facebook and then bring 2 billion people on the platform in 20 years? That is crazy to me. Like, how do you do that, man?
No, absolutely. And I think one way to do that, and I think which is what you're doing with your podcast and with your newsletter, is to increase your surface area, right, of the possibilities to actually happen and stick to it. the more wide the surface area, the bigger and the better chances of you to actually, reaching that. So if you, I'm just hearing you say now that if it took 1 year to, in less than a year's time, if you can shrink the timeline from 25 to 10, you can only imagine what would happen by the end of this year or by the end of next year, correct? So that's the scale of growth that there is.
Yeah, so
So pretty
we just
interesting.
onboarded a startup last week only. I have a call with him again on Saturday. His name is Nick, and he's building a company called Rivian, which is gonna change the name very soon to Loci, I think. And what they are trying to do is onboard young entrepreneurs who are yet to go to college and give them like college experience for 2 years, but it won't be a college. It's basically a
Nice.
place where students can come and do whatever they want to, but like commit to a project. And if the projects are successful, they will take equity and make money out of
Wow.
it.
It
Right.
sounds more like a bounty or a cohort-based courses than anything else, right? I mean, this is how DAOs work, right? I mean, with the bounties, you come in, you participate, you volunteer, and then you get paid for it.
No, in the sense, students who are yet to go to college can just join with an idea, and they have 2 years to build that idea from ground up. And if the idea goes successful, these guys will have some stake in the company. And
Wow.
hopefully by having 2 to 3 wins, they'll be able to pay for all the students and nobody has to pay any fee. So it's
Amazing.
right. And the guy was a AI researcher in IBM before this. And we're just getting started.
Amazing. I think most of what you just said, and whatever we discussed so far, it sounds pretty similar and very close to what Balaji talks about in his book, The Network State, and his philosophy around it. How that the next country is going to be decentralized country of individuals, and not just a country or a state, which would have its own physical borders and physical rules and so on and so forth, right? And it would be a network state and not a physical state. So if whenever you get time, I think you should, get your hands on that book. I think you would really enjoy it. I haven't finished it yet. I've just started, but I think it's a you will love that read.
What do you think about, what I just told you?
I think we just touched upon, multiple, high level points in the last 25, 30 minutes or so. So, but I think that, even if as we progress with technology, and with decentralization and so on and so forth, I think there would still be some basic principles, which would stand true. And I'm purely talking from running a business, scaling a business point of view, right? I think the fact that customers didn't care about your technology back then and they would not care about the front-facing technology in the future, I think that would still remain true, unless you are talking to, unless you are a developer brand or you are, as a product or a service, you're talking to developers directly. Your customers really don't care about technology at the back end, correct? They would always go with how you make them feel. So humans till the time, we don't, or AIs don't take over our thinking capacities and capacities, I think we will still be emotional and irrational people. We will still take decisions based on how a certain company or a certain business or a certain person makes us feel, rather than and despite that person being or that business being slightly more slightly inferior than the other, we would still go ahead with it because it just made me feel good. So there are those certain underlying principles in my view which would still hold true, and those principles I think kind of they kind of cut across technologies, business, industries, countries and so on and so forth, right? I mean different parallels that we want to draw around it. I think, and there are multiple others. I think those will always stand true, is what I feel. And hence, I think, there's this entire hubris around, the AI is going to take our jobs, AI is going to do this, AI is going to do that, it's just going to ruin things for all of us, I think that will not be the case immediately. If at all, I think one way to look at it right now in the current context is to look at technology and to look at AI as your collaborative partner more than anything else, instead of looking at it as a competition, and which is the overall theme in our businesses across the globe today, people don't compete anymore, people collaborate, correct?
Yeah.
You see that with the kind of integrations that any new tool would offer, and it just looks so obvious right now, but even like 3 years or 5 years back, nobody would give integrations so easily, because why would we give integrations to a different business, right? I mean, what would have that done to us? What is going to be the economics of it, and so on and so forth. And slowly people realize it's not about the economics, it's about retaining the customer that you're getting onto your platform.
Yeah.
So I think the way to look at technology and AI also is to look at them as your collaborators and not as your competition, which is the underlying theme right now in most of these, things that you hear about and read about AI. So
yeah,
I think
yeah.
We will find a better way to do it. I think we will evolve in time, hopefully.
Yeah. AI is touchy. It's very touchy.
Yeah, because I have been following generative AI, very closely, and it is mind-boggling with the pace with which the developments are happening, right? I mean, in less than a year's time, you have about 150 odd startups, in some form or the other, it be it generative AI, and within generative there is text to text, text to image, there is voice and audio and so on and so forth. I think it's just, and for us it actually feels the pace is much higher because we are on the fringes and we are just, having almost like a frenzied view of things. But imagine, people behind us in like the 10th row onwards, people don't even know what's happening. So even though we think, it's growing so rapidly, it's just going to take as many years before it gets adopted in a massive way, correct? So the mass adoption of AI in any form, I think, is still a few years away. So not an immediate threat for a lot of people is what I think.
I also think that I got access to Microsoft Designer.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically Microsoft trying to crush Canva. That's what it is.
Correct.
Just to try it out because they have integration with DALL-E. Okay. So it basically, I clicked on new design. It asked me two things. Title of the post and subtitle of the post. So I wrote two things down. And because they have DALL-E integration, they basically created an image out of my description and put that image on a graphic, and the whole thing was just ready in like, I don't know, 50 seconds.
Yeah.
So I basically have an image which did not exist before 50 seconds. So it's the most original image you can have with a graphic behind it. And I was pretty impressed. I was like, what?
Yeah. It's interesting. I think the way things are happening, with Canva also, I think they integrated Mid Journey to Canva, so you can do text to image within Canva now. So they kind of launched that feature last week, or I don't know, sometime
next
pretty
week.
Recently. And it's insane, right? I mean, like, imagine Canva itself was a game changer for people, somebody like me who does not know Photoshop, who does not know any design tools. Canva was a game changer to me, and now imagine like the next frontier, right? It's funny to say that all these things are happening only in span of like 4 to 5 years.
4 to 5 years. Yeah.
So for a non-tech person like me to build my own website, to build my own funneling views, to build my own CMS and dashboard, that itself feels like, it's almost as if I'm graduated from school to college, that feeling of liberation has actually came back.
Yeah. And so I think this is the part where businesses are not realizing that maybe you don't need 7 people to do the whole thing anymore. You need like 2 people who gets it, and you can just do everything maybe with a team of 2 to 3 instead of 7 to 10.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I think the reason I, even after 4 years, I kind of refused to to hire somebody full time is
Yeah.
because I genuinely think that it's a vanity metric. You are not doing, unless I know for a fact that unless I have like 100 paying customers all at the same time,
Yeah.
that is when I would really need somebody. But till
Yeah.
that time, I think automation and efficient time management is a good enough skill, right? I mean, like you can easily do what five people can do today's time. Your productivity is at insane levels, if you use technology to your advantage. So
So how have you been, leveraging tech for your business?
I am keeping it pretty simple right now. My entire tech stack looks like, obviously I'm a complete a no-code believer. I just started my no-code journey about a year and a half back. So right now my websites, they are built with Calt, which is a simple landing page builder. And then I use Calendly to schedule calls, and I use MailerLite to send out emails and to maintain my email automation and my all my communication with my clients and customers. That is it. Three tax tool, that's it.
Wow.
That is all it takes. And obviously then there are certain tools that I use for, there are certain tools to develop web apps and native apps and so on and so forth. So I use all those, but mostly I think these three is what I use. That's it. I've also started to use Decipher. I think you should check out Decipher.ai. It's probably, it does a good job of highlighting and summarizing podcasts. So started doing that for one of my clients, and it's working out good. Yeah.
And what kind of clients do you usually work with?
So they would fall in two broad buckets. One is where I directly work with founders one-on-one, essentially to, I call it being their sounding board, because there are a lot of things that our founders need to discuss and they need to share, especially if you're a solo founder or if you have a co-founding team, but if you're working remote or whatever it is, right? I work with them one-on-one on all things business that they want to talk about, and not necessarily marketing or growth. Where, if they really want to talk about hiring, should I hire or should I not? If they don't really want to talk about product features, if they want to just bounce off ideas, or if they really want to share the customer feedback that they have received, or if they just had their marketing week and they really want to, kind of get some actionable insights from that, so that, and what would be the next step look like? So it depends. So that is one. Second is early stage startups. If for example, if a startup is a bootstrapped one, then probably if they would have 100 or 200 paying customers, I think that would be the ideal fit. Or if they are raising, then somebody who's in the process of raising their Series A, because that's that both these indicators, they are pretty good indicators that A, the product has found the product market fit, and I think businesses, they are ready to scale to the next level, So those are the kind of two broad buckets that I work with. And startups also, mostly they are from B2B tech or SaaS companies. I have deliberately stopped working with e-commerce or content-based businesses. I think the margins, they don't, it doesn't allow them for them to have any outside help. A, B is just the unpredictability nature of the business, right? It just doesn't make sense. You cannot have a 6 month or a 9 month vision with those kind of businesses, and unlike if you're a SaaS, you know that if somebody is at a 3,000 MRR or a 5,000 MRR, that the business will not go out of business next month, correct? I mean, they would still have some amount of runway. So yeah, I think that's what those are the kind of companies that I work with.
And what do you feel about, the kind of, I won't say mistakes, but like the unawareness a lot of first time founders have?
Oh, so I think there are so many things. First and foremost, I think perfection is a myth, is what I keep telling them. You know, it's like, don't wait for the perfect day or a perfect time or a perfect audience to come in. You know, the sooner you put yourself out there, the better the chances of you finding who is and who is not your customer, or what is and what is not your way forward. Correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't make sense for you to, you know, get into this overthinking mode and, you know, put those thinking hats by yourself. I think you can outsource your thinking to your customers, you know? And your thinking is validated by the number of signups, wait lists, or credit cards that you get on your product. I think that is my number one thing. Number two, I think, is people tend to get swayed away by the growth narrative very soon in their journey. You know, people, you know, most founders, my biggest qualification criteria, though, you know, is, are you in here, are you in this business for money, or are you in this business for a long term, right? So despite I know that the business would change, you know, one of the first 5 or 6 questions that I ask the founders, you know, one of the questions is, do you see yourself doing this for the next 10 years, right? And if they are not, so obviously the business will change, you know, they may not run the same company, they may not have the same solution, but, you know, if the problem, it's not as if the problem is going to go away in the next 10 years, right? And if the problem itself is going to go away in the next 10 years, then you're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
Correct? You know, the transportation as a problem is not going to go away at least in the next 50 years, right? So it just gives you that, you know, the cushion of time to work on that problem even more. It could be a different company, different product, doesn't matter, but the problem. So I keep asking them. Now, very few founders actually would have an answer to that, and including myself. Like, if somebody were to ask me that when I started Verbio Brand, like, would you want to do this for 10 years? My answer to them would be like, no, I do not know. I really want to get into it. So I get where they're coming from, but it's always good, you know, for them to confront with these difficult questions right up front, so that they are much more prepared, and you know, when they start on that journey. So yeah, I think these are the 3-4 things that, you know, you would qualify, or at least when I tell them, you have that 10-year vision. If you're not comfortable talking about your problem for the next 10 years, then I think you should relook at what you're trying to do here.
And how do you, you know, propose, look for problems like that?
To the clients?
In the sense, if
a
founder, how do you find problems?
How does a founder find a problem to solve for? Again, you know, it depends from personality to personality, in my view, correct? For me, personally, if I were to look at it, you know, I would rather solve a large global problem rather than, you know, trying to solve my own problem, you know, because the popular advice today, you know, for most of the indie makers or for most of the first time founders is, you know, solve the problem that you want it to be solved for you, correct? Now, well, that works in most cases, right? Now, if I landed in Bombay an hour back, now the biggest problem for me is the weather and the traffic. Now, that problem is for me, but at the same time, that problem is for the other 8 million people or 5 million people staying in the city as well. Correct. So that is not a small problem. It's a fairly large problem. So what is it that you are trying to solve for? If you are here, if somebody, and you know, if your aptitude or your temperament is that your by default mode is always being patient and being long-term, then go for the larger problems to solve, because at the end of it, you're still going to spend the same amount of energy and hours working on that. Correct. So instead of, you know, working on the problem that only 2% of the population has, might as well work on the problem that probably 30% of the world population has.
Yeah.
So it depends what you're trying to solve for. And again, who you are as a person. Like, I have become a fairly long-term kind of a guy, you know, which I was not earlier, honestly. But if somebody were to ask me, as like, you know, what is the 10-year window to this? Or what is the 5-year window to this? Anything less than that is not worth my time. is how I am kind of evaluating things right now.
That makes sense. How was this recording for you? Was it what you were expecting?
I loved it. I loved it. It's almost as if, you know, two individuals talking and discussing different things. I think, you know, different topics.
Yeah.
It felt more like a pretty regular conversation, you know, between two regular people. So I think I quite liked it.